Hello and welcome to another episode of the Leaders Sport Business Podcast, the podcast about leaders in sport from Leaders in Sport. My name's David Cushnan. No James Emmett today, as you might have heard last week. He's on assignment of a sort today at the Cheltenham Festival. We do, though, have a terrific guest on the show a little bit later. Ahmad Nasser will join us. He's the CEO of Winners Alliance, which describes itself as a global athlete-centric commercial solution dedicated to creating novel group licensing, sponsorship, partnership, content, investment, and event opportunities for athletes collectively so that they can win on and off the playing field. We will be telling him to explain a bit more about that. It's essentially the for-profit affiliate of the Professional Tennis Players Association. So Ahmad Nasser coming up shortly. First, though, delighted to say that Jovan Odega has popped into the studio, bringing your trademark positivity and warmth. Jav, it's nice to see you.
Of course, I'm adopting the palms up approach, as a certain DC would appreciate, I'm sure.
Palms up approach on a rainy day here in London, but great to have you in. And I mean, what's going on? You've barely been in the office. You've been out and about, hither and thither, I guess spreading the leaders in EDI word.
Yeah, obviously now the month of March, I think we're fully into the year and all gears are definitely in motion. But definitely one highlight for me, which has seen me on the road, literally was an event which I took part in Manchester, at the home of the Premier League, Champions League and World Champions of Football, Manchester City, the Etihad Stadium. And I had the pleasure of being involved of an event hosted by EISG, Executive and Sports Group. A shout out to Darren Simmons and the team. And it was effectively an event which was put on to unite individuals who are focused on talent acquisition across world sport. And it was an immersive one-day conference sharing best practice of similar minds of individuals who are really focused on, one, creating the best environment for talent, but more so looking at the three R's of recruitment, retention, and reinvesting. And alongside that, of all things which involve people and culture, a key element which was discussed and brought to life on the day was ED&I. So looking at that from a landscape of what are the wins and successes from last year, which myself and Manny Neville, who is the resource and talent manager at the FA, have had a duo act in speaking to, and also setting the scene for what 2024 has in store when it comes down to the space of ED&I. So yeah, it was a really good event, some good people in the room, and kind of just spoke to what we've been doing through the series, through my lens, that being the Leaders Diversity Series, and kind of set the tone for what we liked that space to be over the next 12 months.
Yeah, and we've got lots of things happening in that space, which we'll come on to talk about in a second. Laura and James were talking last week on the podcast about the, I suppose, some of the resistance from some quarters, not necessarily in the sports industry, but more broadly around the concept of EDI.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really interesting discussion. And I just wonder from your perspective, as you've been around and about talking to people in all sorts of different organisations, different roles within organisations, I guess organisations at different stages in their EDI journey, if I can put it like that.
Yeah.
What are you sensing are the elements of EDI that really are speaking loudest at the moment?
Yeah, good question. EDI, I always refer to it as an onion. The more layers you peel back, the more you reveal. And a layer which has definitely become a lot more prominent in conversation is looking at how we are now repackaging the EDI business case. And by that, I'm referring to over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen a great amount of momentum built with initiatives and campaigns, all building and gearing us towards how you create more equitable, diverse and inclusive industry as a whole. We are now seeing a slight shift in terms of where that journey is at, where the campaigning, the initiatives, the having a seat at the table work has been done. But we're now looking at what is next in terms of we're in the room, we're on the agenda when it comes to the conversation. we're slightly now having a repositioning on that agenda where the EDI topic is kind of working its way down as business as usual, as the bottom line and key other business drivers become refocused. So we're now really looking at how can we make EDI move from just being a kind of a good pull on the heartstrings, so to speak, and now position it as potentially as a key business driver. How can it be something that we can relay into making our organization more profitable, or more inclusive, or more well-rounded offering, which doesn't only speak internally but externally facing? And I think we see enough data points to inform that that can be the case. So I think it's how do you now align your business objectives across your various departments to have ED&I at the forefront of driving those endeavors, as opposed to it being just a nice to have initiative, which typically comes to life during particular awareness months.
It's an interesting challenge though, isn't it? I mean, part of the series, part of what we've tried to do and you've led on over the last few years has been about showcasing best practice and drawing out the examples that can really be of use to the industry more widely, the industry at large. I guess if we're moving into a phase where, and it's obviously a good thing this is happening, yeah, EDI is being baked into strategies and baked into the day-to-day and becoming part of most forward-thinking organizations' culture, a lot of that work now is going to be probably less visible. It's the grind, right, isn't it? It's less visible. There's probably less headline-grabbing stuff to immediately sort of touch and feel to showcase. And so I guess that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, isn't it, for sports organizations to keep talking about it, to keep it, public facing and part of the agenda, because it's a little bit like what you sometimes get with international federations in terms of a lot of really critical work around good governance and governance best practice. Yeah. Critical work, but not very visible work, and quite difficult to sort of draw out examples. And I wonder if that's going to be the next challenge for sports organizations, and also, I suppose, for us as we sort of think about how to draw out and tease out the best practice, the best work. It's going to be, I think we're entering an interesting period.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think this period now is one which we find ourselves in, which we must also have a sense of alignment to say we've come to this phase because of the work that's being done. So that's also a good indication that we're now effectively at the next phase of this journey, which is always referred to. And it's about ensuring that we are equipping ourselves with the learnings and lessons that has been built to get us to this point, and now allowing ourselves to have a clear vision of where we're moving to next. But in doing that, making sure it's done in a very sustainable, inclusive manner with the right voices and right individuals at the table to help inform the decisions that hopefully move us to the next phase of the journey.
Luckily, though, we have found some best practice to talk about. And that's why we wanted to get you in, Jav, to talk about something that you have done that people can go and watch on our Leaders YouTube channel. Very snazzy, updated YouTube channel. And this is a conversation about a particular initiative featuring the Lawn Tennis Association, the national governing body of tennis in England, and Amazon Prime Video. So tell us a little bit about how this came together and who you spoke to.
Yeah, sure thing. And it's a brilliant segue to kind of the point you referenced there before, DC, because what we're now looking at when we speak around how businesses can bake in EDI into kind of their more strategic endeavors, a key thing which comes to life, which can bring to fruition, is partnerships, and how you can obviously build and maintain an alignment of skill sets in one place and align them with objectives in another and create impact. And that's exactly what we spoke to in this episode with the LTA and Amazon, which was built around purposeful partnerships. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Joanne Downing, who is the Product and Programs Manager at the LTA, and Louise Goya-Perez, who's a Senior Production Executive at Prime Video Amazon. And we basically spoke to the role that impactful partnerships play within sport, but more specifically looking at tennis and how this can be used to break down barriers for women and girls in sport, and how the coming together of the LTA and Prime brought to life the Prime Video LTA Youth Girls Program, which had two fundamental alignment points of looking at the areas of belonging and inclusion. One from a standpoint of how can we allow young girls to see sport and tennis as something which is open to their involvement and their participation. And not only that, but keeping them playing and moving forward. And in doing that, we saw elements which didn't only speak to the factors of having a racket in hand, but other elements which are quite intangible, such as how you have conversations which brought upon body confidence, leadership, communication, stakeholder management, from a standpoint of developing them for skills which they can obviously transfer into later stages of life. And more so for women, how are we also allowing them to see viable careers in sport, and how are we equipping them with the other element of the LTA strategy in this space, which is around visibility, participation, and the workforce, and ensuring that women have a place in this.
I've had a glimpse of it. It's a really fascinating conversation, and you're a good man. You've brought a clip, Jav.
Yes, we've brought a clip indeed. So the clip we're about to intro you to is looking at the element to which Joe and Louise kind of have a really deep dive into how those intangibles that we speak to have come to life in the program, and how we have elements which that sees this not only as an education piece for the young girls and women who take part, but how this also transcends and morphs into bringing together the family. It's the dad dropping off the daughter, engaging with the coaches, seeing his daughter in this environment, seeing the kind of elements which you can't measure or really have a tick box exercise against. And it's those elements which really allow you to define where true impact can be felt and found. So yeah, please check out the clip and the episode, which is on YouTube, soon to be dropping on Thursday.
What we're trying to do with the programme is to create an environment where girls feel they can turn up and be who they are. They can be authentic, whatever that means to them. Maybe they're super competitive, maybe they're not competitive at all. Maybe they're loud, maybe they're shy. But they come and they can be who they are with other girls in this girl-only environment. And I think that's so important because you're in the same boat as everyone else. There's safety in numbers when you're new to something.
Fun. You're having fun.
Right? You're having fun with other people like you, and that is what creates that sense of belonging. Mm. But then alongside that environment, we've got to be giving these girls some skills. So there's a lot going on in tennis, right? Yeah. It tactically, it's quite a complex sport. Technically, there's a lot that needs to be learnt and developed. And if girls don't get some skills under their belt early doors, are they going to keep coming back?
Yeah.
You know, if you try something and you can't do it, how many times are you going to keep trying before you go, actually, this is not for me? And if you can build some success, then that increases your confidence. And the more confident you feel, the more likely you are to come back. So that skill development and that environment, they're the two things we're trying to address with this programme. And that's what we've been, you know, we've been really trying to make sure the coaches who are delivering the programme can align what they're doing to the needs of girls.
That was Joanne Downing, Product and Programme Manager for the LTA, and she was alongside Louise Goya-Perez, the Senior Production Executive at Amazon Prime Video, and you, Jav, for that fantastic conversation, which, as you said, you can see in full on the Leaders YouTube channel just about now. Jav, thanks for popping in. What else have you got on your radar? What else is coming up? In fact, we've got an event, haven't we?
We do. March brings with it International Women's Day / month. Yeah, I think it's definitely something that should be spoken to and celebrated all year round. And in keeping with our offerings within the Leaders Meet Diversity series, we have our first event of the year, which will be taking place on March 26th. And that will be at the National Tennis Performance Centre, home of LTA. And we'll be co-hosting with them in marking International Women's Day. We're set for a jam-packed agenda, which will feature speakers with representation from the likes of Visa, the LTA. We'll also have our very own Laura McQueen will be opening the event itself. And we'll have IMG, Partners of the Diversity Series. And also in the house will be soon to be announced new partners of the Diversity Series. The FA will also be showing their faces on the day as well.
I think you just announced it.
There we go. And that will also see us kind of move into our usual elements of networking, which will be a bit of a twist. I'm referring to it as an interactive networking session, which will see us have access to the LTA's paddle courts. So do come equipped for a racket in hand and a conversation to be had.
It's the ultimate networking, Jav.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Literal networking. Jav, thanks for popping in. Great to see you. And we will do this again very soon, I'm sure. And do check out the video featuring the LTA and Amazon Prime on the Leaders YouTube channel. Right, we've got Ahmad Nasser, the CEO of Winners Alliance, coming up in a few moments' time. But first, I think it's time for a little bit of sports industry news. And it's time for me this week to do the full rotation on the week's big stories. This is 180 seconds of Sports Biz. A further move into live sports entertainment for Netflix announced this week. It will broadcast a fight between YouTuber turned boxer Jake Paul, 27, and former world heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, 57, in Dallas this summer. Netflix, meanwhile, will not be producing a third season of Breakpoint, the documentary going behind the scenes of the ATP and WTA tennis tours. Financial services firm Ally is sponsoring a first-ever Wrexham AFC women's tour to the US this summer. The news was announced in typical fashion by club owners Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney and put together by a team including Ally CMO Andrea Brimmer and McElhenney's chief strategy officer Kelsey Trainer. Lord Sebastian Coe and former Manchester United player Gary Neville are part of a newly formed task force charged with examining options around the development of a new world-class football stadium at Old Trafford. Coe will chair the group, which also includes Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham. It's assessing the feasibility of what United call a new stadium of national significance. The NBA has opened its exclusive media rights negotiating window with Disney and Turner, a window that runs until April the 22nd. According to our colleagues at Sports Business Journal, the three sides entered talks roughly 75% in agreement on a deal based on their preliminary discussions over the past few months. Comcast and Amazon are also believed to be keen to secure NBA rights packages in this latest sales cycle, with some suggestions that the league could be looking at a total media rights figure of anywhere between $60 billion and $72 billion by the time all its new deals are done. Saudi Arabia has unveiled plans for a new motorsport facility in the under-construction Qiddiya city. The Qiddiya Investment Company has its eye on hosting an F1 race once the venue is completed, potentially replacing current Saudi Arabian Grand Prix host Jeddah. Jeddah has a deal to host until 2027. Malaysia has been offered £100 million by the Commonwealth Games Federation to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games. The Olympic Council of Malaysia is negotiating with the CGF as a short-notice host is sought for the Games following Victoria's withdrawal last year. CGF CEO Katie Sadlier told Leaders in Focus at the start of the year that it was working across four of its six regions to find a hosting solution, and there was flexibility on timing, with a potential 2027 Games not ruled out. Malaysia has hosted the Commonwealth Games once before in Kuala Lumpur in 1998. And that was 180 seconds of Sports Biz. So that was 180 seconds of Sports Biz. As trailed, delighted to have with us on the Leaders Sport Business podcast now, Ahmad Nasser, the CEO of Winners Alliance. Ahmad, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
And you are talking to us from Washington, just outside Washington, that's right?
That's correct, yes.
Very good, very good. It's good to it's good to nail location early on in the conversation, Ahmad. I gave the full spiel, I suppose, on Winners Alliance in the intro. According to your website, a global athlete-centric commercial solution dedicated to creating novel group licensing, sponsorship, partnership, content, investment, and event opportunities for athletes collectively so they can win on and off the playing field, which I'm going to ask you to sort of boil down a little bit and tell us the the simplified version, and then we can go a little bit deeper into various aspects of it. Because I suspect we're not going to be short of things to talk about when it comes to commercializing, collective selling, the role of player unions and what they look like now and in the future. But tell us first of all a little bit about the rationale behind Winners Alliance and how it came to be.
Sure. So quite a mouthful what's on our website. If I were to distill it into basically one sentence, we help groups of athletes both unlock and maximize their value. And that value comes in the form of what they do for a living on the field, on the pitch, ice, whatever playing surface they ply their craft on. And then off that playing surface as well, because we live in an era, for better or for worse, where social media dominates and these athletes collectively have brands that for the first time ever dwarf. If you look at the followings on things like X and Instagram and TikTok of individual athletes and then aggregate them, they dwarf the actual teams. And that, you know, we're seeing a huge change and shift in the media landscape overall. I used to, growing up, I'd have to wait to see what the newspaper in print showed up on our doorstep, said who won or lost the game. And God forbid I lived in the Midwest. My team was playing on the West Coast in the United States, so 3 hours behind, because I'd have to wait essentially 36 hours to find out if my team won or lost and what, you know, who scored how many points and all those different things. And so that whole shift has resulted in a lot of new opportunities for athletes and really groups of athletes, which is our focus. Individual agents represent individual athletes. We will never, and I've never in my career, coming up on 20 years now in sports, represent individual players because they already have that. What we're really focused on is what are the opportunities that we can unlock and then maximize for the group of athletes in any sport that we work in.
And it's worth saying, Ahmed, that you were previously the founding CEO at One Team Partners, which similarly was focused on commercializing licensing rights for groups of athletes. In that case, it was the NFL Players Association and Major League Baseball Players Association at first. Others sort of followed. And you've also, your newer role with Winners Alliance, found in 2022, working very much alongside and in chime with the Professional Tennis Players Association, which you are the executive director of, and also the Federation of International Cricketers Associations. And we'll come on to talk about the exciting work and project you've got going with Michael Johnson in the world of track and field as well shortly. Tell us a little bit about the role at the Professional Tennis Players Association itself, a new organization, a new players union, Novak Djokovic among several high profile players who were some of the driving forces behind that. How does your role there work in lockstep with your role at Winners Alliance?
Yeah, there's two, and so, you know, going back to the One Team, I before that, spent nearly 15 years at the NFL Players Association, focused on the commercial side of our business. Again, groups of athletes, in that instance, NFL players. And we effectively spun that out of the union to create One Team, capitalized it with private equity. So in addition to the rights from the NFL Players Association and the MLB Players Association, as you mentioned, we took over $100 million of private equity investment to build a standalone for-profit entity. And so we learned a lot about how to optimize the models, primarily in a North American context. And so now what I'm doing is with Winners, focused primarily on an international context, right? So tennis, obviously a global sport, cricket, global as well, and then track, which is the newest, but three of frankly the oldest and most watched global sports is really our focus at Winners. But the model is quite similar to what we built at One Team. And that model exists first and foremost to essentially endow each of the players' associations that we work with, right? Create a long-term endowment that powers the advocacy work. So Winners, One Team, NFL Players Inc., we're all commercial entities, for-profit entities that focus on commercial business. The NFLPA, the MLBPA, Tennis Players Association, Cricketers Association, all are advocacy, nonprofit advocacy organizations that exist to serve the members of each of those, the athletes that make up each of those sports, and to really improve their lives on the field, right, and off. But wages, hours, working conditions, anti-doping, a lot of things that have been in the news, those are all issues that we're squarely focused on. And the interplay, for me personally, I mean, those are two distinct roles. You know, we've seen some of my mentors, frankly, Damaris Smith, his new subsequent successor at the NFLPA, Lloyd Howell, a gentleman that I've met several times, have a bit of that dual role. Tony Clark, similarly at baseball, Players Association, having a similar role, and the other players' unions that I've worked with in the past have all. So we've kind of built it on a model that over the last 70 years or so has been quite successful in the context of the Major League Baseball Players Association, the NFL Players Association, the NBA Players Association, and the NHL Players Associations as well.
Good stuff. We're going to come back and dig into all of that in a little while, but did want to get your thoughts on a couple of the stories that we touched on in the 180 seconds of Sports Biz a little earlier. And I guess the first, given your tennis involvement and your tennis interest at the moment, very keen to get your thoughts on the end of Breakpoint, the Netflix documentary, which won't be going into production for a third season. I watched it. I consider myself a tennis fan. I enjoyed it, but it did strike me that the life of a tennis player is quite boring in that it's hotel, court, hotel, court.
Plane, airport.
Plane and airport, of course.
Yeah, that's about 95%.
But the suggestions and the reports say that there's obviously a viewership element to this, which you can probably understand. But possibly even more intriguing than that, suggestions are around player access and a sort of lack of appetite amongst players. You're close to a lot of these players. I mean, what have you been hearing from the players about the good bits and the bad bits of the Breakpoint experience, and what's your reaction to seeing it come to an end?
My reaction is I think it's disappointing, and it's a missed opportunity for the sport overall. It's a missed opportunity for fans like yourself and future fans, because I do think I've had really, really good fortune in my career, for which I will eternally be grateful, to work with NFL players, MLB players, NBA players, women's soccer players, football, women's basketball players, and knowing the good folks at the AFL Players Association and other places, obviously the cricketers and track athletes that we now work with, I have never encountered a group of athletes quite like the tennis players. The difficulties that they endure being in an individual sport, traveling the globe, and really bearing the brunt of all of these things by themselves. And you would think that that would translate into a powerful storytelling arc for players at the top of the rankings, the middle of the rankings, the lower end of the rankings. And for whatever reason, it didn't. And what I'll say about the anonymous complaints about player access and then laying it a lot at the foot of agents of these players, many of those agents and agencies actually represent players in multiple sports. They represent players in golf. They represent players in the NBA and the NFL. And those sports don't seem to have those same storytelling difficulties. So I think it's quite convenient to lay the cancellation on access issues related to agents, because what I really suspect is the case is you have individually owned and operated tournaments across the globe. You have four different Grand Slams that are also individually owned and operated. You have a men's tour, you have a women's tour. So you essentially have no less than seven governing bodies writ large globally. And then you have individual tournaments, of which there are probably 25 to 50 that generate a lot of attention over the course of the year. That is a very, very tangled mess. And for somebody, even a Netflix, to come into that, and especially when they have the experience that they have in other sports, and say, this is way more complicated than what we do in F1, what we did in the NFL, what we do in others in golf. And is that then worth the time and energy to continue to pursue? And obviously they decided it was not. To me, more than anything though, it is yet another highlight of the need to streamline for tennis, everything, scheduling, tournaments, prize money, structure, governance. And this is just the most recent example. Earlier last week, we had an anti-doping case in Simona Halep, right? Not to turn this in another direction, but another example of, it seems like every week there's a case to be made for how the structure of tennis, I'm not going to lay any of these at the feet of the agents or the players themselves, far from it. I think they did the best they could, but within a flawed structure.
Pressure is often applied to athletes in all sorts of sports to, quote, give something back, to contribute to the overall growth of the sport. And it strikes me that that often runs up against the need for athletes to be selfish and to think about number one, because they have finite careers, they have a finite opportunity to make certainly money on court or on track or, you know, on field. Where do you stand as somebody who's worked with athletes in terms of the responsibility that athletes ought to have, should have, to be seen to be growing, promoting, raising the profile of the sport in which they compete?
I don't disagree with that concept at all. I do think, though, it is a convenient, again, if we take a step back and compare sports, in the NBA, I mean, that is the sport, bar none, that people would say those, you know, every night is a show on court. And they're showmen, and in WNBA, they're show women, and in tennis, the men and the women are the centerpieces. I don't think that's any different across sports. I think to lay the entirety, now the NBA has done a phenomenal job over the decades, and I knew David Stern, may he rest in peace, and spent a lot of time with him post-retirement. He actually helped me in the concepting and structuring of One Team. And so here's a former league guy talking to a union guy about business structures and opportunities. But he always used to delight in pointing out that in the 70s, the NBA finals were not on live television, even in the United States, right? Going into the 80s when he took over. And that's a 40-year period, which sounds like a long time, but a lot can change, right? In the United States, horse racing and boxing and baseball were the three major sports at the time. I don't think any of those are the three major sports anymore, with you know, potential debate around baseball. And so things can change. And I think the pace of change has accelerated. But again, they did their job. They had TV contracts. They had events. They had season structure. They had competitive balance. They had all these things in lockstep with their union. They had to negotiate successive collective bargaining agreements that enabled and hopefully encouraged those developments. Same thing in the NFL. We're sitting here in March, the dead of the NFL offseason, yet so many of the headlines are around NFL free agency, right? Which was something that the league fought tooth and nail and that the Players Association pushed for, saying, no, we need this for competitive balance reasons, for labor reasons, for player equity reasons. And oh, by the way, it's going to spur fan interest even in the offseason, which is the longest offseason of professional sports, such that the first day of free agency signing actually generates more media attention collectively in the United States than the Super Bowl, because the Super Bowl is just two teams. And so if you're a fan of a team like myself, the Detroit Lions, that has sadly never played in the Super Bowl, every fan of every team pays attention on free agency, because every team is 0-0. They haven't played a game yet. You know, spring and hope springs eternal in spring. And so, I think that's what's been missing more than anything in tennis. It's not, I think the players, you know, on the whole, are an incredible group of people who are showmen and showwomen on and off the court. They speak, all of them speak multiple languages. They have these lives that are, you know, just incredibly difficult. There is powerful storytelling angles to it. And then in a sport on top of it that is, you know, I would say just a joy to watch, and you know, to have the skill that they have to play at that level is something that people really marvel at.
You touched on the NBA, and we should touch on the story around the NBA's next media rights deal, which is has been going on for a number of months now and will continue to rumble on for a number of weeks. But a key moment this weekend with the negotiating window open for the league's two main existing partners, Disney and TNT. There's obviously a huge amount of money about to change hands. And I just wondered, Ahmed, from your perspective, again, working so closely with athletes, this is a big deal. This is going to be a big deal. It's going to determine the way the NBA is consumed for the next few years. Is this something that NBA players will be thinking about, talking about? Is it the talk of the locker room, or is it just completely not something that, you know, collectively they would be interested in at all?
They are definitely interested in sports like the NBA and the NFL. The TV contracts are massive, and as a percentage of revenue are massive, and they are the single largest contributor to player contracts, salary caps, which are formulaic based on a percentage of revenue. So those opportunities don't come along often in general. And then given the shift in the media landscape, the legalization of sports betting in the United States, I know it's been legal in many other parts of the globe for much longer than that. The impact of that in a broadcast deal has yet to be fully realized. And so I think players are definitely paying attention now, whether it's the talk of the locker room or you know, traveling in between cities, I can't say, but I can tell you that player leaders in the NBA and player leaders in other sports, I'm sure in the NFL, they're following the story closely as well for similar reasons, because that whole market is fairly tied together, and the importance of live sports in today's media landscape, where you can consume pretty much everything else on demand, is you know, a hugely important factor, probably the singular factor from a player compensation standpoint.
Good stuff. All right, let's talk about what's happening in your world, Ahmed. And one of the big headlines over the last couple of weeks has been this partnership between. Are you calling it a partnership? Is it a strategic alliance? What is the terminology?
With Michael Johnson?
Yeah.
No, partnership. No, we that's probably the best word. That's a word that gets overused, frankly. But we are co-creating essentially with Michael. A series of new opportunities for track athletes across the globe. And we met Michael mid last year around this idea that he's been carrying. Obviously, Michael, with the coolest Zoom background I've ever encountered in my life, with his gold medals over his left shoulder and his gold cleats over his right shoulder, and somebody who works for the BBC to broadcast current track events around World Athletics and the Olympics and some of those other opportunities that currently exist. And, you know, it's one of those sports that will capture the focus of the world around the Olympics every 4 years, right? Paris coming up later this year, and those, that 100 meter, 200 meter, 400 meter relay, you know, all of those events are going to captivate the world. And then what happens after, right? Whereas look at tennis. We'll come off of Wimbledon, we'll have the Olympics, and then everybody knows what's next, the U.S. Open, right? And so there's not going to be any doubt about where the Olympic gold medal winner for the men or the women or the doubles are going after Paris. But I don't, I frankly couldn't tell you right now where the winner of the 100 meter race in the Olympics and gold medal is going to be racing after the Olympics. I don't know if there's opportunities, and that's where we want to fill the void, because we know a track is literally, and this was something Michael and I bonded on when we first met in person, it's literally the oldest sport on the planet, right? I mean, the cavemen used to race each other. And then the joke is that when they caught up to each other, then wrestling is the second oldest sport because they'd wrestle. So you literally have this sport that is like literally in our DNA. You know, you're out trying to outrun danger, you know, thousands of years ago. And here it is, it's still in a very pure form, and for whatever reason doesn't have the opportunity set and the contract, the commercial structures that we see in other sports. And so what Michael and his team and our Winners Alliance team decided to embark on is let's try to change that. And let's anchor it from an athlete perspective. Michael being not just a former track star, but one of, you know, frankly, a handful of track athletes across the globe that has the gravitas to be able to pull something like that off. And then us with the experience that we've had with athletes across the globe, because I'm also very interested in the fact that tennis players, track stars, other than their countries, there's no jersey, right? There's no Lakers logo, and then LeBron's name is on the back, right? And the Lakers logo has, deservedly so, a lot of value, just like a Cavaliers logo or a, you know, Miami Heat logo had before on teams that LeBron has played for in his career. But in track, it's really you, right? And how fast you run. And in tennis, it's you. And yeah, okay, if you're playing on a grass court wearing all white, we probably know you're at Wimbledon. But other than that, it's really just, you know, who you are as an athlete and who you're playing against. And so that lines up quite well into our core thesis of the unlocking of value and then maximizing that value. And so we think there's a lot of opportunity in track for both men and women, which is another thing that is core. Everything we're doing with tennis, cricket, and now track creates opportunities for both men and women.
Presumably, though, I mean, it sounds like from everything that the announcement said and what you said there, part of this, a significant part of this, is to set up a new track series, effectively, which seems a you know, one step up, if you like, from a licensing agreement. So, I mean, what sort of additional challenges do you expect that to bring? And is this is this something that you think could be a model for a Winners Alliance going forward into other sports?
It could be a model. I think everything that we do is through the prism of the athletes. So, you know, cricket, tennis, arguably have too many events on the calendar, right? And when I started at the PTPA and when we created Winners Alliance, a lot of people came to us and said, you should create the PTPA Cup, right? And I looked at the calendar and I said, okay, where would, and by the way, as an athlete advocate in tennis, one of the core things I keep pointing out is there's no proper off season. When are these athletes supposed to rest? When are these fans supposed to have the scarcity of product, right? I mean, even the NBA has a longer season, so does the MLB and the EPL, but you still have proper off seasons where fans can then gear up and sponsors and teams. And you have a never ending, almost 11 and a half month. And by the way, the month that you're not playing as much is December, where you've got the holidays. So you barely have any opportunity. So I don't know that we can say that every sport is going to have the same types of opportunities. I think track, it was a glaring one. And there will be some things that we have not done before with other groups of athletes as it relates to track. But also, we're not doing all of this at Winners Alliance. That's why we partnered not only with Michael, but with GST. So it's a separate entity that we are going to work with, which is a little bit like what we've done in partnering with the PTPA, partnering with FICA, the Federation of International Cricketers Associations, and anybody else that we'll partner with in the future. They all bring certain expertise and know-how, and we expect the same of GST. And we've met the team, and you know, they're currently building a team separate and distinct from Winners Alliance, and we will help in the areas that we think we're experts at and that we've been able to demonstrate value in the past.
So it sounds like this, you know, I think this will be seen as a challenger, as a new, you know, almost a disruptor in some respects. And I know Michael Johnson has been really clear in the quotes he's given that he would like this to be complementary to what World Athletics is doing, particularly around the Diamond League as the regular calendar of events. And there are obviously pros and cons to the Diamond League structure and calendar as is. Do you think that's realistic? That it can genuinely be complementary, or will inevitably be there be an element of friction here as this comes to life? And actually, is the friction a bad thing necessarily?
Right. Competition is good. I would tell you it, and we've seen that in the PTPA context, right? I mean, the mere fact that we exist has prompted a lot of improvements for players. And at the end of the day, that's all we exist to do. So does it have to be branded with our brand? No, right? So I would tell you in track, from what I know, it is absolutely a reasonable thing to hope for a complementary and symbiotic relationship, right? Diamond League has existed for a while. The fact of the matter is that the top most competitive sprinters in particular don't race all the races. It's not set up in a way that incentivizes them to compete on a regular basis, especially head to head, which is exactly what the fans want to see. So and they get to see at the Olympics, and they might get to see at the World Championships. But outside of that, they don't get to see it. And you know, it's not dissimilar to golf having the Masters and the British Open and the US Open and then, yeah, the regularly scheduled PGA Tour. I'll leave Liv aside for a moment. And even in tennis, right? You have Wimbledon, you have the other Grand Slams in Australia, US and France. You have the Olympics and Olympic years, and then you have the ATP on the men's side and the WTA on the women's side. I think it's a careful balance though, and I think it's important, and it was important for me that Michael was, you know, Michael is very friendly with Seb Coe and the folks at World Athletics. They are very aware and familiar and supportive, frankly, of what we're trying to do. And that was important to me because I think it's important that players' associations and groups of athletes at the right time be very firm. And if they need to have sharp elbows, have sharp elbows. But it's also important that we don't needlessly walk around the globe poking people in the eye because we think that's the only way to succeed. Far from it. In fact, I think that's how you risk, you know, splitting up the playing group of athletes. That's how you risk damaging sports globally for fans. And we've seen that in other sports, thankfully, none that I've been directly involved in.
Let's zoom out a bit and talk more broadly about the concept of player unions and these for-profit entities that are springing up alongside them. You talked a little bit about the need for them, the opportunities that they potentially unlock for athletes. Tell me a little bit about how the decision-making process works. So, for example, I think with the PTPA, you just did a big deal with Fanatics. Is that right? And
yep.
In that example, what's the decision-making process on signing that deal off? Is it something that has to be put to the members? Are you, as the for-profit entity, given sort of license to go away and do that and sign that off on the player's behalf? Take us inside the mechanics of it.
Yeah, so licensees like Fanatics with trading cards and apparel, Electronic Arts and 2K, primarily Big Ant Studios in many multiple sports. And think about those, I'll really focus on 2K EA and Fanatics and Panini as two of each of those types of licensees. And in every sport that they create products for, they all work across multiple sports, they prefer a model where they can go get, say, all of the NBA marks in one license. So the Lakers, the Cavs, the Heat, they're not going team by team. Similarly, they prefer a model where they don't have to go to 450 individual NBA players and their agents to do a license deal. They can go to one entity. And historically, going back decades, that entity has been the Players Association, primarily in hockey, basketball, American football, and baseball. And so from that has, you know, when video games became a thing 30 or so years ago, similar dynamic for the likes of Electronic Arts and 2K, looking for, you know, to make a game of the kind that they make, they want multiple teams, athletes in there. And so what's the most efficient way to accomplish that, right? And really solving a market efficiency. So the way it works is the players individually assign their group rights to that entity to then essentially bundle and go do deals. And that colleges in the U.S. do the similar thing. And each individual athlete gets to sign up or not, right? And so there have been notable exceptions over the years. Michael Jordan was probably the most prominent example of that in the NBA in the 90s. As far as I know, every NBA player is a part of it now, which was a question we were asked in tennis. And I said, well, if LeBron over here, right, top end of the spectrum, is part of his group licensing program, and then, you know, player number 12 on the bench that you and I don't even know their name is also a part of that same program and part of the union, they're probably onto something, right? And so what you do is you find that means that an individual watch deal that an athlete may have, that's up to his or her agent, right? An individual endorsement deal, individual sponsorships, appearances, that's the purview of individual agents. But these broader collectivized deals are really optimal in a group licensing context. And so that's what we brought to tennis. That's what we're building in cricket. That'll be a part of what we build in track, of course, beyond the actual events. And that's really the bread and butter. And then from there, there's lots of different ways, permutations to structure deals and structure the companies around that, because I would tell you my own thinking over the last 20 years has evolved on that, right? I went from working at one union with one group of athletes to spinning that out, scaling across sports, bringing in outside capital, and then creating from whole cloth instead of spinning out Winners Alliance, what we're doing right now over the last 2 years.
Do you get any pushback from any of the key stakeholders sort of involved in the environment here, whether that's player agents, whether it's the leagues, whether it's, you know, individual teams, and how do you navigate any sort of pushback on any of this stuff?
Yeah, yes, definitely. But I'll tell you, given that the purpose is to endow players' associations, it's no surprise. I mean, the whole notion of organized labor generates immense pushback, right? And has for probably 200 years, going back to the Industrial Revolution. So I just view this as the 21st century iteration of, you know, that struggle. And it's not, it may sound odd to compare professional tennis players to Uber and Lyft drivers, but there are some parallels there that are very important. And Starbucks workers and Amazon workers, because when you have a construct where each of us as individual human beings who are workers in whatever craft we happen to work in, whether that's driving a vehicle or swinging a tennis racket, we have certain rights and we bring certain value to the equation. And in tennis, that value is immense. And in technology, that value is immense. And so it's no surprise to me that when there's a new model that endows the ability to advocate for, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of professional athletes globally, that that's going to generate pushback from anybody who's not on the athlete side. Now, you asked about individual agents. I would say that every agent that understands the model is supportive of the model because it frankly is free business development for them and creates immense opportunities for them. It is, and we never charge athletes commissions, right? So our business model, we cannot charge individual athletes a commission the way an agent might charge their clients a commission. So we charge Fanatics and EA and 2K. We're providing an efficiency that they derive value from, so then therefore they should be paying for it. We create new opportunities for the individual athletes and their agents. So once they're educated on that, and I just went through this, you know, I had to do it in the NFL context when I joined, baseball, women's soccer, women's basketball, similar dynamic at one team. And then now at tennis, I think tennis was the toughest test because individual athletes, individual agents, individual sport, not even employees of any one entity, right? Independent contractors working across the globe. And we now have over 400 players part of our group licensing program, not because they're doing anything but maximizing their own individual interest in a good way.
And as you move from collective licensing, if you like, into maybe slightly more sophisticated areas of commercialization, are you actually pricing in a little bit more pushback in the system as you go into different sports where the dynamics, and every sport has different dynamics, of course, but it actually, is that something that you're willing to accept and sort of build into your planning as these for-profit entities evolve, emerge, grow, and become more sophisticated?
Yeah, I mean, that it's interesting because Leaders has a newsletter, right? And there was a little item last week on exactly that topic that talked about entrepreneurial almost risk, right? For lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And I think 10 years ago, my answer to your question was absolutely. Because when I was at the NFL Players Association running our for-profit arm, which was a subsidiary, right? I had to advocate to hire more staff to do these things or to invest in resources or technology. And in that context, it was incredibly difficult to advocate for more budget. And essentially, if you think about it, the risk was borne entirely by one union, the NFLPA. And so when we created one team, we said, let's spin this out to essentially offload as much of that risk, that entrepreneurial risk, as possible while still keeping a good amount, if not the majority, of the upside value and benefit, right? Which is why, and watching what Fanatics has built, I met Michael Rubin in 2012, right? Before anybody knew who he was or white parties or any of this stuff, and before Fanatics was worth even over $1 billion. And now it's worth $33 billion. And unions have owned, and the NFLPA has equity in Fanatics back to we finalized the deal in 2013, but back to that time, and we've seen the growth trajectory over that time. And so the trick over the last, you know, from going from the NFLPA to one team to now Winners, is I think we've moved down the spectrum of the risk profile, because I agree that unions themselves internally should not be taking entrepreneurial risk. What they should be doing is partnering with people that can offload as much of that risk, pay them as much money annually, in addition to having equity value over time, but not sit there and say, okay, Ahmad, you know, now you're asking us as an NFLPA executive committee of players to approve an increase in your budget. You know, I learned that the hard way, right? For years, I tried to advocate for one more head, two more heads. Let's do a pilot program. Let's grow. And then I realized, wait a minute, this whole model, it's unfair to the players to say, and even if I succeeded in that, I'm asking a bunch of players now to plant seeds with me that may not sprout until a next group of players, a new group of players comes along, right? And so that in and of itself was, you know, almost an unfair ask of me. And so finding a way to spin out, but still have some measure of control, approval rights, equity value, you know, ultimate what happens. And that's a balance, because I think every union goes through a version of what I experienced at the NFLPA, which is, you know, is this the right model? And over time, the NBA Players Association is a great example. For years and years and years, David Stern paid them a fee and got the rights directly from the union, right? And bundled it with the NBA. So you had the teams and the players all at one, selling to the likes of 2K and Fanatics and others. And when Michelle Roberts took over, she made it a platform, you know, to take those rights back in-house to the union. They then created their own for-profit subsidiary, staffed it up, and you know, now they've two executive directors later, they're evaluating that model and trying to figure out what's the right balance. And I think what we did in tennis, zero of our employees on the PTPA side work on the commercial business. They are purely advocates for the players. They travel the globe, going to tournaments. They're working on anti-doping, fine appeals, benefits, you know, travel, all the things that, from an advocacy standpoint, the players need and haven't had over the years. And the entirety of the commercial operation sits on the Winners Alliance side. Cricket, it's a blend of both, but more like tennis than American football. And then in track, you know, we'll probably have a blend because it's a different structure, and again, being created from whole cloth.
Final question, Ahmad, and really appreciate you jumping on today to chat all this through. It's absolutely fascinating. Are there sports that you think this model would work particularly well for?
I'm going to take the easy answer and say that I think a version of this model, not the same version, but a version of this model should work in every single sport that's out there. Because again, athletes are human beings. And no matter what sport they play, or even if they drive a car for Uber or Lyft, they have rights and they have needs and they need independent representation. And so because of that need, you need a way to fund that independent representation, right? You could just go around and ask the members to pay dues, but that's not going to fund a very strong organization. It's certainly not going to fund an organization that has resources over the long haul and a war chest to be able to maximize things like a collective bargaining agreement as they come up, a television negotiation as they come up. Players should be retaining their own advisors on TV deals. Back to that question you asked about the NBA, right? We did that in the NFL Players Association context to make sure that the process was right and optimizing the right factors from a player perspective. And so if we understand that need, then it becomes, well, what's the best way to fund it and to build strength collectively? And I think this model that is a hybrid, support the advocacy work of these nonprofit labor players associations while offloading that entrepreneurial commercial risk and creating value over the long haul in things like Winners Alliance, I think that model or a version of it can work in every sport. And if we look at the deals we've already done across tennis, cricket, and track, there are similarities, but each of those deals was totally different. And I think that model and that flexibility, as long as the athletes are at the core and that advocacy work is at the core, I think that model can work across sports. And I know that wasn't a great answer, a bit of a dodge, but I truly believe that.
It was a bit of a dodge, but we'll forgive you, Ahmad. It was a good answer nonetheless. And look, we do really appreciate you stopping by to chat all of it through. Come and see us when you're over for Wimbledon in the summer, and look forward to catching up again soon. Ahmad Nasser, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me.